Blog Talk Radio.
You go busting your fist against the stone wall. You're not using your brain. That's what the white man wants you to do. Look at you. What makes you ashamed of being black?
Number love for you. I even know how hard it is. No doubt. Being a woman, a black woman at that. In this white man's world. Sometimes we overlook the fact that we can ride hard in our streets, we won't be knowing the pain we can cause. This white man's world, this white man's world. I ain't saying I'm innocent at all, man. I'm just saying this white man's world. It's on, yeah. For all those times that I messed up or we messed up.
Dear sister, got me twisted up in prison, I miss you. Crying, looking at my nieces and my nephews, picture. They say don't let this cool world get you. Kinda suspicious, swearing one day you might leave me for somebody that's richer. Cap off the bottom, I take a sip and see tomorrow. Gotta make it if I have to beg a bottle. Beating love letters, late night, locked down and quiet. If brothers don't receive they mail, best believe we ride. Eating Jack Matt, staring at the walls, inside of the sausage cage where they captured all my ways and bonds. In time I learned a few lessons, never fall for riches. Apologies to my true sisters, far from bitches. Help me raise my black nation, reparations to do. It's true, caught up in this world, I took advantage of you. So tell the babies how I love them, precious boys and girls, born black in this white man's world. And on the road,
she did.
didn't have a daughter, she did have a son. She said the lift doesn't run, run up the stairs and come. And if it don't come quick, you're not gonna know that plan. So I grab a bunch of clothes and I started to run. Here I come, whoa. 2 months later, she said, come and get your son, cause I don't want your baby to come tie me down. Now because you are old and I am young, yes, while I'm young, yes, I wanna have some fun. Run me down, shouldly waddle diddly woodly diddly whoa. Swing, I'm broad, I'm broad, I'm broader than Broadway. Yes, I'm broad, I'm broad, I'm broader than Broadway. When you go to Volcano, it's like a stage show. You have man that swing DJ and blow. Pull it down, it's ready. She didn't have a daughter, she did have a son. She said the lift doesn't run, run up the stairs and come. And if it don't come quick, you're not gonna see your son. So I grab a bunch of clothes and I started to run. Here I come, whoa. 2 months later, she said, come and get your son, cause I don't want your baby to come tie me down. I got you are old and I am young. Yes, while I'm young, yes, I wanna have some fun. Run me down. Exercise, exercise then size way. Extra broad, extra broad, extra broader than Broadway. And the intercom rolls, they tell me to come. But she didn't have a daughter, she did have a son. Here I come. Green, cause I'm broad, I'm broad, I'm broader than Broadway. Cause if you don't come quick, you're not gonna see your son. So I grab a bunch of roses and I start it to run. Here I come, whoa. I come, whoa. 2 months later, she said, come and get your son, cause I don't want your baby to come tie me down. Cause you are old and I am young, young. Yes, while I'm young, yes, I wanna have some fun. Run me down, shoodly rap, boo, boodly diddly, whoa, whoa. Swing, cause I'm broad, I'm broad.
Babies, how I love them, precious boys and girls, born black and white.
white man's world.
And all I heard was,
to my homie's head, died in his vest, shot him to death and left him bleeding for his family to see. I passed his casket, gently ask him, is there heaven for Jesus? My homeboy's doing life, baby mama be stressing, shedding tears when her son finally asked that question. Where my daddy at? Mama, why we live so poor? Why you crying? Heard you late night to my bedroom door. Now do you love me, mama? Why they keep on calling me nigga? Get my weight up with my hate and pay him back when I'm bigger. It's still tucking in his jail cell, missing my block. Hearing brothers screaming all night, wishing they stopped. Proud to be black, but while we act like we don't love ourselves. So look around, but suck, check yourselves. Know what it means to be black, whether a man or girl. We still struggling, and it's white man's world.
White man's world.
We must fight for brotherhood.
Direction and a blink of an eye. My time away just made perfection. You think I die? Not going wrong. Why should I care? Like we holding on to lost love that's no longer there. Can you please help me? God bless me, please keep my seeds healthy. Making all my enemies bleed while my G's wealthy. Hoping they bury me with ammunition, weed and shells, just in case they trip in heaven. Ain't no G's in hell. Sister, sorry for the pain that I caused your heart. I know I've changed if you help me, but don't fall. Rest in peace to Lil Tasha, Lil Yummy and Kato. Too much for this cold water to take, ended up being fatal. Every woman in America, especially black, stay with me, can't you see that we under attack? I never meant to cause drama to my sister and mama, but when we make it to better times in this white man's world.
You're out of touch with reality. A few of you in a few smoke-filled rooms calling that the mainstream, while the masses of the people, white and black, red, yellow, and brown, poor and vulnerable, are suffering in this nation.
Never that. And white man's world, they can't stop us. We've been here all this time, they took us out. They can never take us out.
The seal and the Constitution reflect the thinking of the founding fathers that this was to be a nation by white people and for white people. Native Americans, blacks, and all other non-white people were to be the burden bearers for the real citizens of this nation.
My name is Asada Shakur, and I was born and raised in the United States. I am a descendant of Africans who were kidnapped and brought to the Americas as slaves. I spent my early childhood in the racist, segregated South. I later moved to the northern part of the country, where I realized that black people were equally victimized by racism and oppression. I grew up and became a political activist, participating in student struggles, the anti-war movement, and most of all, in the movement for the liberation of African Americans in the United States. I later joined the Black Panther Party, an organization that was targeted by the COINTELPRO program, a program that was set up by the Federal Bureau of Investigation to eliminate all political opposition to the U.S. government's policies, to destroy the Black liberation movement in the United States, to discredit activists, and to eliminate potential leaders. Under the COINTELPRO program, many political activists were harassed, imprisoned, murdered, or otherwise neutralized. As a result of being targeted by COINTELPRO, I, like many other young people, was faced with the threat of prison, underground, exile, or death. The FBI, with the help of local police agencies, systematically fed false accusations and fake news articles to the press, accusing me and other activists of crimes we did not commit. Although in my case the charges were eventually dropped or I was eventually acquitted, the national and local police agencies created a situation where, based on their false accusations against me, any police officer could shoot me on sight. It was not until the Freedom of Information Act was passed in the mid-70s that we began to see the scope of the United States government's persecution of political activists. At this point, I think that it is important to make one thing very clear. I have advocated, and I still advocate, revolutionary changes in the structure and in the principles that govern the United States. I advocate self-determination for my people and for all oppressed people inside the United States. I advocate an end to capitalist exploitation, the abolition of racist policies, the eradication of sexism, and the elimination of political repression. If that is a crime, then I am totally guilty. To make a long story short, I was captured in New Jersey in 1973 after being shot with both arms held in the air and then shot again from the back. I was left on the ground to die, and when I did not, I was taken to a local hospital where I was threatened, beaten, and tortured. In 1977, I was convicted in a trial that can only be described as a legal lynching. In 1979, I was able to escape with the aid of some of my fellow comrades. I saw this as a necessary step, not only because I was innocent of the charges against me, but because I knew that the racist legal system in the United States, I would receive no justice. I was also afraid that I would be murdered in prison. I later arrived in Cuba, where I am currently living in exile as a political refugee. The New Jersey State Police and other law enforcement officials say they want to see me brought to justice. But I would like to know what they mean by justice. Is torture justice? I was kept in solitary confinement for more than 2 years, mostly in men's prisons. Is that justice? My lawyers were threatened with imprisonment.
I just want to spend a minute talking about a couple of the, you know, some of the parallels between mass incarceration and Jim Crow, and then, you know, the end of that. I once I get started talking here, I can go. But consider some of the rules and laws that apply to those labeled felons today and ask yourself if they remind you of a bygone era. Denial of the right to vote, right? 48 states and the District of Columbia denied prisoners the right to vote. Now, mind you, that's not the case in other Western democracies. You know, in fact, in other countries, there are often voting campaigns within prisons. There's voting drives within prisons. In other democracies, you don't forfeit your citizenship when you go to prison. you're still a person. You're still a citizen. You're still part of that country, even if you're in prison. You get to vote. In the United States, nearly every state denies prisoners the right to vote, and that's just the tip of the iceberg, because then once you're released, you can be denied the right to vote for a period of years, maybe until your probation or parole expires, or for the rest of your life. It's up to the individual state. And nationwide, about 1 in 8 black men are either temporarily or permanently disenfranchised as a result of felon disenfranchisement laws. Exclusion from jury service. You know, one hallmark of the Jim Crow era, of course, was all-white juries, you know, particularly in the South. Well, these all-white juries have had a roaring comeback in recent years. Why? Well, in part because anyone convicted of a felony is considered automatically ineligible for jury service. Automatically ineligible for jury service. And then, get this. If you've ever had a negative experience with law enforcement, you could be struck from a jury for cause. You know, prosecutors able to persuade the judge that that negative experience that you have in law enforcement might bias your judgment in a criminal case. Now, good luck finding.
Right.
Many African Americans, particularly of Portuguese color, who have not yet had a negative experience with law enforcement that conceivably biased them in a criminal case. So even in some areas with relatively large black populations, you see all white or nearly all white juries.
Today, officials decree that rapper Brad Jordan, alias Scarface, must be stopped. After being monitored by Secret Service agents for 2 years, evidence leads tobacco and firearms officials to believe that his literally dope lyrics promote drug usage and distribution, degrade women, influence gambling, promote and teach violence, and more importantly, it's influencing our minors and destroying our communities. Officials say he's the lord of underground rap. Him and his music must be stopped.
We got this whole motherfucker on the mission. Now the whole entire world has gotta try to come up with a quick decision. They claim we threats to society, and now they're calling on the government to try to make somebody quiet for the bullshit they done to me. Gangsta Nip, Spice, Warden, and Tupac never gave a gun to me. So gangsta rap ain't done shit for that. I've even seen white folks from River Oaks don't get to get. So why you trying to kick some dust up? America's always been known for blaming us niggas, but they fucked up. And we were always considered evil. Now they're trying to bust our only code of communicating with our people. Let's peep the game from a different angle. Matt Dillon pulled his pistol every time him when someone tangled. So why you criticize me for the shit that you see on your TV? That's freaks worse than PG. Just bring your ass to where they got me, so you can feel the hand of the dead body.
Nigga, don't believe that song. That nigga's wrong.
So now they trying separation and sending black folks in white coats to infiltrate our congregation. Tapping into our conversation, taking the message that they get, bring forth wrong premeditation. So David's got a silver mask while listening to Brad. David gets pissed and killed his dad. David Duke's got a shotgun. So why you get upset? Cause I got one. A biscuit, a casket. A nigga got his ass kicked, shot in the face by a cop, closed casket. An open and shut situation. Cop gets got, they wanna blame it on my occupation. If you don't dig me, then nigga, you can sue me. Cause the shit that I be saying ain't worse than a Western movie. Don't blame me, blame your man Gotti. So you can feel the hand of the dead body.
Nigga, don't believe that song. That nigga's wrong. Gangsters don't live that long.
You better free
your mind before I free my nine and stop fucking with Detroit up top. I feel my hot rocks. Bang, bang, boom, boom, ping, ping. I'm the black, white boys got a magazine and don't know how to act. I attack and make you vomit. Down with Khaled, I do my homage. Dewey got a brother, I'm McNeil. I'm the illest, wanna kill this house nigga, Don Cornelius. Can you feel this? You punk niggas make me sick. Sucking on the devil's dick, scared of revolution. Needs to start douching. Houston is the place. I caught a case. The motherfuckers tried to put a scar on my face. But I bust two times to the guts. Do the Reverend Calvin bust. Got a pair of nuts. I started this gangster shit in 86. Now you're dissing me for publicity. Isn't he a hoe to the third degree? Who me? I'm a G that like to scrap a lot. Down with rap a lot. And I can't stop, won't stop. So fuck Bill and Hillary. Ice Cube, it ain't no killing me.
Say, we always say the Black Panther Party that they can do anything they want to us. We might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletariat. I am the people. I'm not the pig. You've got to make a distinction. And the people are going to have to attack the pig. The people are going to have to stand up against the pig. That's what the Panthers are doing. That's what the Panthers are doing all over the world.
Fred.
Black Power, Black Power, Black Nation. You're tuned into In Defense of the People weekly Tuesday night broadcast at 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern with your host, People's Political Party National Chair Nat Turner, co-host, National Minister of Defense, Brother Motherland, myself, and our engineers on the ones and twos, National Minister of Communication, Sister Amina. Call in each and every Tuesday night, same black place, same black time at 845-277-266. Press 1 to participate. Tonight's topic, why Thanksgiving? Why Thanksgiving? We're going to open up our phone lines to our national chair, Nat Turner, Uhuru, Black Power, and all power to the people, black people specifically. Comrade, can you hear me?
Right on. Black Power, all power. Right on. You know, this past week, you know, they had was known to Thanksgiving, and the average person in this country has celebrated, partook in it and whatnot, you know. There's a time and a place, you know, sometimes, and for certain things, and just. We talked about last week, social engineer, like, you know, of our youth and stuff. And just as an example, a classic example, if you will, what, you know, the whole Thanksgiving thing has come to mean, has come to be in terms of the American population. Now, which has been socialized. Mine has been point where, you know, it doesn't really own its own thoughts anymore. And I say it, you know, like the population here in this country. The European worldview of things, the European concept of interaction with one another, you know, the European concept, of course, interacting with indigenous black and brown people on this earth, you know, on this planet, and which has been a grave disaster for those who have been the original people, indigenous people, native people, aboriginal people, original people, or, you know, born from the earth people, earth-born people. Who populated the planet and, you know, come later in time to be displaced by a small group of people. And I say that because the Europeans, the so-called Europeans, are the minority people on the earth, and they've set themselves in a position of privilege, a position of rule, a position of dominion, and establishing that through violence, and then taking the booty, which is a word that derives out of war and defeat, and the victor taking booty from those that he has conquered. And that in itself, that term, has been transferred on to the colonized mind. And we, as black men, the male American population in general, now has transferred that term, or is the inheritors of the transference of the term onto the posterior women. To come here, and when I say to come here, I mean the land, the region from the top of Canada to the bottom of Chile, and what we are told is a north-south direction geographically. And do the kind of work, the type of strategy, plan, after violently unseating the indigenous black and brown people that were here, that, you know, had been here in no monolithic sort of physical way. Several different black and brown tribes, you know, with their own unique physical features and head textures and whatnot, you know, from virgin on jet black to reddish brown complexions. And to be later on mixed in their blood type with the invader, the descendants of the invaders, the descendants of the conquerors who conquered the indigenous people here. The word conqueror, you know, is similar to the name or the term that was given to those who did the conquering, the conquistadors, which I believe is Spanish or Latin, somewhere in there. And then after so many centuries or a number of centuries, take that and romanticize it. This is where the visual media wing of the state comes in the name of Hollywood or motion picture. There's a movie that was made 1492 featuring one Christopher Columbus, who we are told had made more than one voyage here near the end of the 15th century on these ships, the Nina and the Pinta, and this shit come right out of my brain, you know, like right out of my thought process, because of the, you know, the conditioning, you know, the brainwashing, the, you know, the teachings that have been ingrained in my mind since since I was a boy. And of course, in middle school and high school, you start learning these names and whatnot, you know. just some background with that word, people, some context, if you will, and understand where we're going with this. It's a song that Public Enemy, what I feel is the greatest rap group of all time, because of their willingness to forego all of the wealth and luxury and the expensive living and, you know, and whatnot, and so forth, in exchange for taking the time to educate us through music, through hip-hop, through rap music, which is a part of the hip-hop culture. And they had an album, a very genius way of naming their albums, you know, that Public Enemy displayed. And it kind of, you know, kind of get a little confused, but something to the effect of the music and our message, you know. And the word message they took and, of course, split into two syllables and on purpose. When you say a mess, what a mess, you know, I've made, or what a mess you have made, and age, and music, muse, and to be sick, music, and our message. I mean, genius, you know, a skeleton with a pistol to the head, and I believe a 40-ounce bottle as the album cover. And on that album was a song called Hitler Day. And this song hit it, you know, right on the head. You know, how could you call a Holocaust a holiday, you know? And then the song just goes off, mass murder, you know, taking the planet, you know. Then he just start doing celebrate the black, brown, and the red, you know, turn this planet into a sewer, you know, and whatnot, you know. Then the hook is, there's a sample hook where it goes, you know, I don't hate nobody. And then they come along in rhythm, you know, but this day is crazy as Hitler Day. You know, and then it keeps going on, hanging heads, snapping necks, splitting up can, making families wreck. An extraordinary idea, song. And if you listen to it, it sums up the whole shit about Thanksgiving. You know, it's a holiday. I used to, learn to say, a long time ago, that the European holidays have been holidays for the Europeans, but they have been holidays for non-whites. The non-white Anglo-Saxon Protestant population of the world. And the whole idea about this turkey, you know, I used to wonder, you know, why a turkey, you know, because everything has an origin, you know, point of origin, and people, you know, dress certain ways to go to balls and whatnot, you know, the reason for it, you know, football players wear helmets, the reason for it, you know, and it's just started wondering about why a turkey, you know. But this notion about Thanksgiving, when I was a child, remember we used to cut out these turkeys and whatnot and paste them on a paper, like making like a little book, like, you know, have a cover, like, you know, just do that kind of shit, you know, down like the coloring books and whatnot, you know. And these books had these pictures, these images of so-called pilgrims dressed in their blue and white or something like that with these top hats. And you know, they would show this beautiful scene, you know, a long wooden table with all the food and the big turkey and whatnot. And the so-called Indians and the pilgrims got together and they sat down and, you know, thanked their God or the Lord for their possessions. And it's really, you know, amazing. It's an amazing display in psychological warfare. It's an amazing display of how the conqueror, the descendants of the conquerors, can later push this kind of psychology, you know, for the so-called Indians. Thanksgiving is the opposite. It's a day of mourning, and the average Joe and Joanne in the black community hasn't a clue. You know, if it's, I would say 10,000 of us in the room, in the facility, you know, that has the space to hold 10,000 people. I would say maybe one person in there knows, is cognizant of that kind of shit. And it's, you know, it's a, you know, like a slap in the face, you know, to push this story. You know, every Thanksgiving, of course, not the only day, I'm quite sure, that the native people, the indigenous people here, what's left of them, take exception to this holiday. The other one is Columbus Day. You know, in Columbus Day, there's protests against with people come to understand that Columbus, to my understanding, made Hitler look like a choir boy by the things that he did, the genocide that he committed against the black and brown people here. More particularly, it was not known the Caribbean, which was named Hispaniola. Of course, Hispaniola has a word or similar base root of the word Spain. Spain, Spanish, and whatnot, you know. This is why, of course, the people in Mexico, from Mexico, like I said, to the bottom of Chile, speak Spanish in most cases. And other portions speak Portuguese, such as is the case in what is now known as Brazil, where, as a matter of fact, there's 80 million black people in Brazil, which is the largest black population, probably outside of the African continent. You know, now we can take this word black and, you know, define it or whatever. But, you know, using, you know, this we speak in English, right? But, the brothers and sisters in Brazil speak Portuguese. And, of course, they speak Portuguese because of the Portuguese people who had come as conquerors, you know, from Portugal, Spain. A lot of people believe that Christopher Columbus was a Spaniard. Excuse me. But Columbus was an Italian. And how the name went from Columbus to Columbus. His name was Cristobal Colon, C-O-L-O-N. And
I started, you know, wondering, gathering, had his last name been the root or the predicate or the base of the words like colonize, colonial, you know, because it seems to have this the five letters and put a I-A-L on India, colonial, right? I don't know if that's based on fact, and I'm not sure. But I found out his last name, you know, was Cologne, I was like, well, damn, you know. But it makes perfect sense, you know, in the fact that people who came, they were colonizers, and the indigenous people became their victims. They became the colonized. I mean, the colonizer, pushes his ways onto the colonized, on those who would become colonized, or even through violence, you know, persuasion and whatnot, and force, you know, and so become the colonized. You know, you take on the mentality of the colonizer. And this is where it's at. You know, this is where we are today. The present non-white population here is taking on the, you know, the mentality, the sick, twisted mentality of the colonizer. And we're right there with them. You know, we're with him in all the holidays that he's conjured up. Christmas and whatnot, you know, so forth. Another one just slipped my mind, but it's so much. But you know, we're right here with them. The Fourth of July. Yeah, the Fourth of July, which is the bastard child of, the so-called Columbus. And like I said, you know, the beginning of that song, how could you call or, a takeover, a discovery, or whatever, you know, something like that, you know, and disregarding the indigenous people here. And then transforming them, not totally inside out, but enough for them to have abandoned their, their original way of life. And of course, that includes their spiritual worship, the God that they've always known. The relationship between, you know, all forms of anatomical life, in its relationship to inanimate objects. You know, and what I mean by inanimate objects just simply mean, you know, a rock doesn't move, you know, unless something makes it move, you know, by force, right? And so forth. A tree has branches and, you know, and yeah, they can move the leaves provided that something, you know, makes them move. You know, the inanimate world and the animate world, through the eyes of psychology or psychic indigenous black and brown people, are considered to be one, that all of these physical forms of creation possess some type of a spiritual force. And that the Europeans, when they began to, you know, themselves up as the rulers, as the lords of the land, and then they began to study the people that they violently victimized. And one of the things that they studied, of course, was their religious belief, because the Europeans were claiming that they were bringing the three C's to Africa. They were bringing the three C's to what is now called Latin America and so forth. And the three C's, to the Americas. And the three C's is commerce, capitalism, commerce, civilization, commerce, and Christianity. The three that go hand in glove. And so they were, you know, claiming that they were doing that. And so with a Bible in one hand and the sword in the other hand, conquering and calling themselves Christians at the same time. Now, there's a way that this shit got to be done in order to pull it off, to legitimize their treatment of the indigenous black and brown people, which would conscious claim and therefore rule with no conscience, or rule with impunity, pretending that they were civilized themselves and that they were Christians, that the Bible was the way of the world. And that would, since the indigenous people didn't have that, then that gave them the right to do what they did, proselytizing, you know, the Christian missionaries coming here to do their part. Yeah, there's a number of books that I just come across over the years, and these, like these monks or the Jesuits, these Franciscan monks or whatever you want to call them, the Jesuits and whatnot. Some of these voyages, you know, were equipped with a so-called father, you know, a so-called religious man, somebody from the Catholic domain. And on occasion or two, these so-called monks or fathers, whatever, friars or whatever, would they kept diaries, and these diaries later gotten published into books and logged as the history of the conquest of the Americas. And some of them that had come here had witnessed savage treatment, you know, the animal nature of the Europeans, and had written about it in diaries. And one book had gotten published by an author. His name was William Prescott. And the name of this book is The History of the Conquest of Mexico. And you look at the cover, and the cover itself says it all, you know, where it has a white man on a horse, you know, getting ready to, you know, to do his thing with the sword, you know. And you see the indigenous people, you know, about to become his victims. And, of course, you know, they all weren't afraid. You know, they fought back gallantly. But this is one of the books that have become sort of a monumental piece in the realm of the historical storytelling or the narrative and whatnot. And when you read it, you know, it tells, you know, the real picture. You know, it gives a fairly decent account, you know. And to be the descendant of the Europeans and then be able to profit from what, you know, the today's Europeans have been able to profit in incalculable ways. So it was only fitting that the Europeans would start building a type of mythology, if you will, to circumvent reality, to subvert real true historical narrative, and that the media apparatus that the Europeans own and control of, media is very, very, very crucial. It's very powerful. They would not be able to do what they're doing without being in control of media. And of course, part of that, part of media is imagery. And this is the kind of imagery that was ingrained in my mind as a boy, you know, by this picture of the so-called Indians and the pilgrims sitting around the table carving up a turkey. I haven't gotten to that part yet. You know, and celebrating and giving thanks for the things that they have. It's incredible. It's really incredible. Just picture, you know, being the original, you know, population, you know, occupiers of a land, you know, peopled a part of the world that hadn't been peopled yet. You know, and there were several migrations or periods of time, you know, tens of thousands of years, you know, and but just, you know, you know, help me understand how they were able to sit at a table with the descendants of the conquerors who used violence, or the accomplices, if you will, right? And, you know, give thanks to the God you know in your language for the things that you have when it was the things that you had. You know, it's incredible. It's incredible. So this is what the Europeans were able to do. Wield this notion, the impression. The specific story goes where the so-called Indians known as the let me see if I can say this name right, Wampanoag nation, you know, that they had took in, you know, some Europeans and welcomed them to the land and whatnot, and, you know, taught them, you know, how to, you know, live and survive and whatnot, and friended them. And then they, some point, got together and they started sitting down peacefully and eating, you know, food and whatnot. Pure bullshit. You know, the most brutal kind of treatment. Careful here, you know, not to use certain terms of, short of the treatment of African people, short of the treatment of the black population that had been turned into the second source of labor. The Holocaust that the indigenous black and brown people went through, and the treatment of black people during the physical slavery era, and the almost total transforming of another group of black and brown people. No. I use black and brown indigenous people as a way to get people to understand the different, you know, the different types, the different tribe, the different tribal types. You know, there's to this day, you know, there's still some you know, groups that have their particular language that they were able to hold on to due to resistance, you know, due to some type of resistance. Tropicana to the bottom of Chile, especially in South America, you know, where you know, you if you travel in certain places there, in Brazil even, you know, you'll see black and brown groups you thought would never even exist. And that's due to the usual image of betraying the Indians. You know, the usual image that we today see as Indians. You know, a lot of times, you know, if not most of the time or not all the time, like right damn near white. You know, there are some whites who are claiming they have Indian blood in them. You know, as amazing as that is, you know, but the usual imagery, you know, that is shown and introduced to us. There's some so-called Indians who are totally integrated into American society and woven into the American fabric that has been sewn together, you know. Of course, dipped in blood, you know, totally integrated. And, you know, these are the ones that they, you know, would introduce you to, introduce your children to, you know, as Native Americans and whatnot, you know. But in pockets and places, you know, in South America, you know, certain places still left in North America. So fortunately, you see vestiges of the darker groups, the virgin on black types, you know, jet black hair, you know, Hershey bar chocolate complexion with the high cheekbones and whatnot, long straight hair and so forth, you know, and in South America, you know, and so forth, you know, more curly hair types and so forth, you know. The anthropological record, of course, you know, shows that, you know, this word about black and what's black and this, that, Negro and all that kind of shit there, these are descriptive terms. As a descriptive term to describe, you know, this certain physicalities and whatnot, you know, to where people can understand. The Greeks had a word that they used whenever they saw people who were dark-skinned, you know, brown shades of people and dark and, you know, virgin or jet black. They referred to them as Ethiopians. Because of the word Ethiopians, this definition that supposedly means somewhere along the lines of burnt face. In other words, sunburned black or black as a result of the effects of the sun and whatnot, you know, with the deep skin pigment and so forth, right? Well, people that were here almost wiped out. Again, from Tropicana to the bottom of Chile. But a lot of them were able to maintain and still speak their indigenous language. And understand now what Europeans and their philosophy of capitalism has meant, not only for them, but indigenous people around the world, you know. And, you know, from a generational thing, you know, something passed down, it's become inherited, you know. Not only with, you know, the conquered, the colonized mind, but of course the descendants of the, as I said, you know, the descendants of the slave drivers, descendants of the conquerors, those who have set themselves up as the lords and masters from the top of Canada to the bottom of Chile. As another book called A Century of Dishonor, the classic account of our government's mistreatment of Native Americans by Helen Jackson. And she had lived during those times. You know, she had lived in the 19th century. where in the sleeve of the book, it says, in 1838, the state of Georgia compelled 17,000 Cherokee Indians to undertake a forced march west from Georgia to Indian territory. The march, later known as the Trail of Tears, claimed thousands of lives to exposure and starvation. The central design is the classic account of the American government scandal, the treatment of Native Americans. Arthur Helen Jackson also recounts the unfair and immoral treatment of other tribes, including Olalla Sioux, who were moved 8 times in less than 25 years in the nearest parish, who were thrown off their reservation during the gold rush of the 1860s and 1870s. Now, this gold rush and how the West was won, right? As a matter of fact, I'm going to show you how the descendants think and that they have been the profiteers of this gold rush. We know there's a state called California, named after the so-called California Indians, and that inside one of these states is a place called San Francisco. And this term sand just so happens to be a very prevalent, you know, beginning part of a lot of some of the names in California, San Fernando, San Francisco, San Diego, and whatnot, and so forth and so forth. But there's a city called San Francisco. And as a result of the gold rush, the Europeans who founded the NFL team of San Francisco decided to take for his nicknames the San Francisco 49ers. And the colors that they chose, gold, red, you know, which you see every Sunday, you know, or in most cases where they're wearing their gold, red, white, and, you know, I guess some black stripes in there somewhere, whatever. But, and that is how they got their name, the San Francisco 49ers, the Gold Rush of 1849. And it shows you how they are fond of their of their ancestors' legacy. The Cherokee, the so-called Cherokee Indians, who had, of course, went through, and the U.S. manufacturers of automobiles had taken a Jeep or a sports utility vehicle, whatever you want to call it, and named it the Cherokee. You know, the college football team in the state of Florida, of course, the Florida Indians. And now the college football team is called the Florida State Seminoles. You know, and it's amazing display. And these things are right in our face. And you know, we history is has been sort of set up where it's convenient, in other words, you know. It's convenient at times to go into history and, you know, pick and choose and, you know, leap over or whatever, whatnot, so forth. I guess in more recent times, And of course, all of this is connected. You know, the post George Floyd phenomenon that is taking place, the reactionary Europeans, and this is a play on the minds of black people. You know, to keep black people, pull black people back in the bag every time, you know, something happens, black people get on the verge of rage. You know, and they have blood in their eyes or whatever. You know, we have blood in our eyes collectively as people. And as a sort of psychological maneuver, as though white people all of a sudden are now just learning how to be sensitive to other groups who are non-whites or people of color. And so what they do, they change the name of the Washington Redskins, and I believe the name of the Cleveland baseball team. you know. But look at the replacement of the name, Redskins. You know, they say, well, we can go one better. So get rid of Redskins and come up with another one. And now they call the Washington Commanders. The Commanders of what? The Commanders of a military fleet. You see, the Commanders of an army. And so they're still able to sort of get closure themselves. But the whole point is that the, you know, the insult, the here, you know, we're rubbing it in your face, what's left of you all, so forth, you know. By calling our team Redskins. And that is a no more, no less than a symbol of I have conquered you. You know, I've conquered you. You know, look, I've conquered you. You know, I own you. You know, I am your Lord and Master. And the logo of the Cleveland Indians baseball team, with the Indian smiling with the big white, you know, perfect set of white teeth, you know. And it's no laughing matter. But to us, you know, it's a smiling Indian because this is where we're at with it. You know, this is where we're at with it. You know, but the George Floyd thing and the reactionary whites, reactionary Europeans decided to, after 500 years, finally display some type of, and I struggle to even say the word, but some type of sensitivity to the so-called Native Americans or Native American culture. You know, the, as a matter of fact, the I believe it's the Native American month that's we're in or coming up or whatever the case may be. Thanksgiving itself, the day on a Thursday, right? And when they, after establishing this Thanksgiving, the world of sports decide that they would remind the Indians of what happened to you. You know, we're gonna sit down with you, and but on the same day, in our world of sports, that we're the proprietors of, right? That we're the owners of the teams, that we're the owner of the league, and so forth. We hold all the, you know, the. You know, the deeds and the stocks and the property, I mean, the patent rights and so forth, right, to the sport of football. And so what they decided to do was put the Dallas Cowboys on and let them play on Thursday. And before too long, it would occur to them that, well, even though this is Thanksgiving, and that we're, you know, this is what this is supposed to commemorate. Even though we, you know, partake in that, what we're really going to do is remind you of how it got this way by playing the Redskins and the Cowboys on Thanksgiving. You know, the Washington Redskins and the Dallas Cowboys on Thanksgiving. What better way could they have shown, you know, their true feelings about Thanksgiving than, you know, having the Dallas Cowboys play the Washington Redskins? You know, now when I was coming up and I started realizing this shit, I've been hating Dallas from one. You know, I've never been a Dallas Cowboys fan, no way, shape, or form. And I can remember that from the time I was a little boy. But it was something about the Redskins that appealed to me. You know, and I would start understanding as a boy, as a early teenager and whatnot, you know, then teenager, and then it just started making sense. And so a form of rebellion against the Dallas Cowboys, and that the Redskins were the team that I should be rooting for. You know, there's no way, shape, and form that I could root for the Dallas Cowboys. No. And so that is how the Redskins had become like one of the teams that I liked, you know, the uniform and stuff. But it never really registered to me the nickname, Redskins, you know. And so this is what we do every year, you know. And so they played again. And I don't believe it's coincidence that they played Dallas and Washington, because now, and man, you know, I can't say this enough, but we really have to understand how this shit works, like, you know, in order to liberate ourselves, you know, from the white supremacist construct and its different tentacles, you know, from capitalism on down, you know. But there are people who sit in so-called high places and plot this shit up, and contemplate this stuff and think on this shit. Really do. I mean, they really do. And it's no coincidence that they had Washington playing Dallas this year. Because after all, the Washington team is now known as the Commanders. You see? So that makes it even greater. You know, the Commanders, you know, are playing the Dallas Cowboys. Okay. And sort of a rebirth of the Washington football franchise under a new so-called nickname. We make nothing of it because a lot of us, you know, we're walking around, you know, with our heads on our asses, and it doesn't really like register. Some people probably aren't even fazed by it. We are not fazed by something, you know what I'm saying? But the way they're able to pull this shit off, you know, and then make it profitable, you know, at the same time, you know. There are those who, of us who are, you know, black, on paper, on record, wherever you, those of us who are, you know, discovered our roots, who, you know, profess to be having ancestors who, you know, see themselves as an indigenous people, you know. You know, the thought that would come, you know, across my mind about this topic, this subject. And this is no subtle message, nothing like that to anybody, whatever, you know. But the consequences or the impact of that alone, you know, should lead to rebellion. You know, I mean, it should, and it could. But what I'm saying is, even those of us, you know, who would have a Negro or whatever, African-American or whatever on our birth certificates and whatnot or whatever. Those of us who have, you know, discovered that, you know, there are people didn't come aboard no ship, you know, as part of the slave trade, and would have been the victims of the same type of treatment the groups who are usually portrayed to us or presented to us collectively, whether you're black, brown, red, yellow, or white, as Indians. Now, I have a lot of things in my possession, you know, a lot of pictures, you know, just you know, doing, you know, my homework, you know. And I used to take these pictures and show them to, you know, the little brothers who were being held in the junior concentration camps. And, you know, it would literally blow their minds to see, you know, like dark-skinned people verging on black, you know, like they've never seen when you say Indian. You know what I'm saying? Negro, Indian, Ethiopian are the same terms and meaning, but what is referred to as related languages, is so-called Indo-European branch of the family of languages of humanity, or whatever, you know, Greek, Latin, French, English, you know, German, and this lesser known language, you know, that's known as Sanskrit, right? Which, you know, is supposed to represent, you know, the Indo-European languages spoken pretty much by white people, pale-skinned people. And these are descriptive terms, you know, as I talked about Ethiopian and whatnot, you know. But the fact that, you know, this country, this land was a part of a larger geographical boundary that has been confiscated by force, and then those who were transformed into a slave a slave population. And of course, yeah, you know, some whites were here, they were working too and whatnot, you know, and all, you know, whatever. You know, it's no big deal, you know. But my point is, why Thanksgiving, right? And the reason why Thanksgiving, you know, is to, again, you know, to keep the same structure intact, the same psychology, the same efforts in psychological warfare, the same generational thing, so white male patriarchal rule can continue to perpetuate itself. Right, and nothing changes. The colonized still act out the mind of the colonizer, reconstituting one's self and to be rebellious in a way that would deconstruct, you know, your colonized mind. And this is where it has to go. This is where it has to go. Now, I don't think it's anything wrong with people sit down and have celebrations, you know, they cook food and whatnot. You know, normal thing to do. You know, it's not like this shit just started with white people. White people came along and started, and they just come up with something. Now that was like the spinoff. Like Flavor of Love, from Flavor of Love, it's a spinoff, you know, went from there to Atlanta Housewives and Soul Love and Hip Hop movies, spinoff on reality TV shows and shit. It's not like it was that. It was celebrations and whatnot forever, you know. Black people, indigenous people around the world have always been doing, you know, having feasts, and a lot of these feasts, more times than not, were most likely based on some type of work. Spiritual worship, you know, thing, you know, appeasement of the God, you know, that they've known under many different names, that the Europeans now say gods, you know, the gods, and to legitimize the treatment of those who had gods, and replacing their gods, these pagan gods, with the one and only true God, and so forth, that the Bible speaks of, who the average person or a church-going person calls the Lord. You know, even that in itself, the conditioning, you know, because the white man in Western Europe uses that term of his lofty position within society, you know, and how that word knives got transferred over into, you know, the average Joe and Joanne, you know, we say, Lord have mercy, you know, how we just speak, you know, we talking and we don't really, you know, really understand what we're saying. And that's why some of us have tried to take the opportunity to go back and say, okay, well, what did we call God before, you know, before all of this? Like, you know, what did we do, you know, looking back to indigenous culture and people and understanding, you know, the names and stuff like that. And this is a reconstitution of the mind, you know, psychologically and of course spiritually and whatnot. You know? But you know, this notion of you know, the so called Indians and these pilgrims getting together and sitting down and having a feast and whatnot is bullshit. No. It's incredible because, you know, Europeans will not let non-whites do that to them. You know, the Europeans will have blood in their eyes. You know, the Europeans would wait for a moment to seize the time to take their shit back. And then they, you know, history, you know, would be celebrated, you know, as the heroes who fought against, you know, evil people or people who, you know, took things that didn't belong to them. And it was their right, you know, war and peace. And that's actually a sort of, you know, how like some people say like a dissertation, you know, in college and whatnot, you know, your thesis, you know, you know, to earn your master's degree or whatever and shit, right? Bachelor, arts or whatever, right? You know, you write whatever your thesis and shit like that. And that is where, you know, this shit actually stems from, the rights of war and peace. Forget his name, but he lived like, I think like the 16th century, the 17th century, some 17th century up in there, you know. And this is where they get their international law about war and peace and the rights of war and all these kinds of things and shit like that. He was a Dutchman or whatever, you know. And the Dutch were in the business of doing the same shit, you know, actually like, you know, contemporary with the rest of the whites around the world and you know, land grabbing through violence. And then when the indigenous people decide, you know, that they couldn't take it anymore, that eventually it was a law of nature that they wouldn't be able to take it anymore in the first fucking place, you know. So it's no extraordinary thing to be in awe over, you know, to be amazed at. It's just that when they decided to stand up and you know, reclaim their lives, now the labels come in, you know, savagery and barbarity, and now terrorism, you know, which is the new kick. Terrorism is the new kick, you know, the new fashion, you know, the new jive, you know, the new strategy of reverse psychology, you know, if you will, you know what I'm saying, homeland security. It's amazing. You know, it's amazing that they have homeland security. Even Donald Trump, when Donald Trump is talking about doing what he wants to do, you know, he become president, he's going to put up a wall and you're going to keep these Mexicans out of here. We're going to keep these non-whites out of here. We're going to keep these black and brown people out of here. But we can, you know, turn the blind eye if some white nation comes under attack to some inherent contradiction due to class structure and or the carving up of the earth or the fight for natural resources, these resource wars, and you know, which may turn out to be the whites battling the whites in some instance, like what you see over there in Ukraine, and that somehow, some kind of way, these people will flee, you know, and some of them will make their way here, and they're welcome with open arms, you know. But even Trump himself, you know, when you get to talking about, you know, the country and it's our country and we fought for it, you know, he didn't say that we took it. He said that we fought for it. You know, that was a way of saying as though it was you know, two people pitted in a duel and they both agreed, you know, to fight. You know, and you know, this whole shit, but it's a reality that's here. It's a reality that you know, is gonna be here, and you know, the conditions, the conditioning of those who are held hostage psychologically. You know, that is why Thanksgiving, you know, some of us will become militant black radicals or revolutionaries, excuse me, so forth. You know, we'll become conscious of the European holidays. There was a brother named Shaka Musa Barashango, you know, who will write these books about the European holidays, African Holocaust, European holidays. There's several other books been written. Dr. John Henry Clark, one of our great ancestor historians, radical historian, who was part of Malcolm X's secret, you know, research team. And there's a book, I believe, a little small book called Columbus and the African Holocaust or something like that, whatever, you know. There's another one called Columbus and Other Cannibals, written by, I believe, someone who, you know, refers himself as Native American or have Native American ancestry, whatever, you know. Of course, that's, you know, that's another, you know, discussion there about whatnot, this term Native American. As I, you know, kind of just briefly, you know, mentioned, you know, earlier, you know. But, you know, some of us have, you know, taken our minds back from it. Some of us don't celebrate Thanksgiving. You know, we see it as, again, you know, like in that song, what Chuck D is saying in Hitler Day song, when you talk about, you know, how can you call a takeover a discovery, and then, you know, the descendants have the nerve to manufacture a holiday, and some people have this notion about celebrating Columbus, or not celebrating Columbus, but, you know, in memory of Columbus, you know, and his great discoveries and whatnot, you know, which is no total contradiction, you know, when it comes to it, again, the indigenous people here, the indigenous black and brown people here, you know, and, you know, what they've gone through, you know, what they've been through, from the top of Canada to the bottom of Chile, I mean, to the bottom of Chile. And the part about the turkey that, if I can remember correctly, I had come across this explanation at some point some years ago. The something to the effect of, there's a country called Turkey, okay, and there's been these Turkish wars or whatever, you know, historically, and of course the what is referred to as the Ottoman Empire. And the Muslim Caliphate, right? The Muslims on one end, in the East, and the Christians on another end, in the West. And if you look at a map of what is referred to as Eurasia, which is no more, no less than a combination of the two words Europe and Asia, which is supposed to be two separate continents, right? But if you look at the part of the map where Asia is supposed to be east of Europe, or Europe is supposed to be west of Asia, there's a sea, or a lake or something like that. I can't think of the name. It's just this water, this body of water on I think the Hellespont or something like that, on where you can actually, you know, like people take tours like you know, on a ferry and whatnot, and you know, it sail out there, and you can, you know, like over there is Europe, but right over there, you know, you see this land over, that's Asia, you know, and that land that they're talking about, also known as Asia Minor, right? Where there's an Asia Minor, must be an Asia Major. Like if there's a Near East, you know, in the Far East, then there must be a Far West. Okay, if there's a Far East Asia, then there must be a Far West Asia, right? Where that land that's to the east is the country of Turkey, which would be up Northwest Asia, which is incredible in itself, you know. But that part is actually referred to as the Near East. Okay, so there was these wars, the breakup of the Ottoman Empire. Okay, the Muslims had been pretty much, you know, like supreme in this part of the world. And that the Christians, these battles that they were having going back and forth, you know, had conquered this part of the world, this country that we know as Turkey. It was also known as Anatolia, you know, where they, you know, they found these old structures, you know, man-made structures and houses and whatever, temples and whatnot, like, you know, 10, 15,000 years or whatever, old, something like that, right? 10, 12,000 years old. And that part of the world right there is with, you know, this battle. And that, the story goes that the Europeans had chosen a Turkey to institute as their main dish, as the, you know, the predicate of the feast, right? A turkey. And that when they would, the man of the house, the man would carve the turkey, that was a symbolic remembrance of how the Christians had defeated the Muslims in the region of Turkey. And so that became the symbolism. That is how that turkey had got into the picture. This is something that I ran across years ago. Yeah. And it, you know, is you know, you could be astonished by that kind of shit. You know, it could be quite astonishing. You know, when you learn these things, because like I said, I used to wonder, you know, what the turkey was for, like why a turkey, why it wasn't chickens or shit, you know, whatever, you know. And I said, why a turkey? You know. And so this is the symbolic continual defeat of the Muslims, you know, the breakup of the Ottoman Empire and so forth, you know. And of course, you know, the Europeans and the expansionist era, that's how they were able to start making their way into what is referred to as the Near East, you know, the British, you know. They would start carving up, you know, what is referred to as West Asia, the Near East, among themselves, you know, making themselves the lord and masters of this part of the world. And, of course, their ambitions about dominating or being in control of the natural resources in that part of the world. And, of course, the number one resource in that part of the world was the oil. And so this is how they begin promising other groups, you know, these internal conflicts within, you know, the groups that had been living in that part of the world. There's the group, the can't get their name, I was on the tip of my tongue. The Kurds, because of a part of when you look at a map, you see like Turkey, Iraq, Iran, something like that. Okay, at some point in time, you know, these regions touch each other, right? And at some point in time, each one of those regions was known as a place called Kurdistan. And this is how the people today are known as the Kurds. So up there, they're like pawns in the game. And the Kurds have you know, gotten it from some of everybody, you know, from left, right, you know, whatnot, you know. And so this is, as we speak today, this is the dilemma today. You know, there's a war that's going on up there now. You know, and the United Snakes has taken, you know, the Kurds, played them off as pawns, the British has done it, and the Muslims done it, so the whole shit. But that is how that whole thing, you know, come about, you know, with the Turks. And like I said, it's all connected, you know, it's all connected. And it's a way to keep people at bay. And it's a way to keep people to constantly promoting, you know, the colonizer, you know, where the colonized, unbeknownst to him or herself, unbeknownst to Joe, you know, the Joe and Joanne, you know, unbeknownst to them that, you know, we give them something, and we celebrate with them, you know, we sing and clap and dance with them, you know, and make them feel like they belong, you know, make them feel like they belong, because when you make people feel like they belong, then that makes them feel important, like they're important, like, you know, again, like, you know, people come from voting and so-and-so, like, you know, my vote counted, you know, and then, of course, the media wing of the state, you know, they're producers and whatnot, you know, they'll make these, you know, these neat commercials and, you know, just get some unsuspecting person and be in a commercial and, you know, you just get them to say this line, you know, and whatnot, you know, and that is how that works. Now, this portion of it, and I won't be able to say this enough, but this portion of it here is a Machiavellian strategy, it's a Machiavellian tactic. And as a matter of fact, Machiavelli had something in common with the Prince, who had something in common with Columbus. You know, they were Italians. And so this is how he was able to instruct the Prince in all the arts of psychological war in order to protect his holdings, in order to keep his holdings, in order to maintain his holdings. And in one of those, one of the ways to, you know, to control the crowd, like Rakim said, you know, on the mic, you know, mesmerize the crowd, you know, on the mic, or not being mesmerized by the mic, you know, but mesmerizing the mic in order to control the crowd, right? It's a song he wrote. It was a pure genius. But that is one of the strategies, tactics that Machiavelli would teach the Prince. He would teach him, you know, every now and again, you know, hold a festival, you know, hold a festive event, you know, and you know, you know, mingle with the people. You know, be in the midst of the people. You know, you must sing and clap and dance, you know, with them and make them feel like they belong. And this is something the strategy and tactics have been in overdrive. Bill Clinton perfected it. Bill Clinton perfected it when he was running for president. He perfected it, you know. And then, of course, the when the football game is playing, of course, there's these commercial spots that they do, you know, when they come, well, after commercial spots, when they, you know, come back, like, to the game, and you see, you know, selectively choose, you know, some football players or whatnot from, you know, each team or whatnot, and they'll get them to sit there with their family and their children. And, you know, it's all part of it. It's all part of it. And when it comes to black people, you know, it's big time. You know, it's big time. You know, we celebrate with the descendants of the power brokers. You know, the stockholders. You know, the Europeans will sit there and talk that shit. And, you know, all that jive about I had nothing to do with slavery, and you know, that was such a long time ago. And I've worked hard and I've earned, you know, the things that I have, house and, you know, and whatnot, you know. But then turn right back around and try to tell you about justice, right? So then they tell you about justice. The Europeans, they broke every treaty known to the so-called Indians. They broke every last treaty, several hundred treaties. They broke them all. Couldn't keep one. No. What they set up as the reservations, no more than what we call the ghetto, you know, the hood, being fenced off, being put in a controlled environment, the same strategy and tactic that they use in Australia with indigenous black and brown people, the same shit. The reservations, no more than what Southern Africa referred to as the Bantu stand, you know, a controlled environment where the people would finish themselves off, you know. And so forth, you know. But you know, in these commercial spots, you know, and I'm gonna tell you, you know, a lot of us take a lot of things for granted. A lot of us take a lot of things for granted. But it's no laughing matter. You know, when the shit hit the fan, you know, some of us will be casualties. You know, we have this notion that. The things that have taken place in other parts of the world where the people have rose up and the people have liberated themselves through revolutionary means, through sacrifice and whatnot, that America, it can't happen here and whatnot. But the seeds have been sown, and the results of those seeds are coming close to full blown. And but anyway, you know, you see these, you know, these, again, these things where they take the players and they get them to fans, and you know, you have a brother, and you know, he was a saint, but his wife is white, you know, in this spot. Now I mean, so man, you know, man, you go with that, you know, with that trip shit again, man. People gonna love what they wanna love. And I understand that. See, but you know, the NFL is most of the majority of black brothers, and it should be proportion of black women being chosen, or black football players with black wives to be in the spot saying happy Thanksgiving. And I'm not saying it ain't never been done before, but there's these things are strategically done. These things are strategically done, you know, at certain moments of time, certain points of time. And it's very important that they do them, because it's very important that they do them, because they keep black people off balance, especially black men, you know, to keep us in constant static with our women, with our sisters, you know, to impress upon our boys 10 years old, you know, when they become 17. You know, 18, and they go into the prime. You know, and they choose the girl to go to their prime, and then when they, you know, go off to college or whatnot, and so forth. And so, and quote unquote, so-called make it out into larger society. You know, we end up with a non-white woman, a non-black woman on their elbow. You know, all that's by design. And that was part of the Thanksgiving strategy and tactic, directly targeting the black population, the black male population, from young to old, specifically. But this is why Thanksgiving, and so all the indigenous brothers and sisters, you know, we say that Whitey has taken the land, he's been taking the land, and he's set himself up using other people's labor for the most part, and it created a capitalist structure, infrastructure, that has kept them in a larger position. And those were the willing, who some refer to as flunkies or as functionaries, the nine whites, the black, brown, red, and yellow, who have decided to join him, who have decided to acquiesce in exchange for, of course, material comfort, or material luxury. And that at some point, this shit is going to boil over. And we can see the pot simmering, you know, with the lid on it. And the lid is vibrating now, you know, because of the you know, the heat and the force of the steam. And the water's pouring over the edge and whatnot. This is where we're at. Realistically, let's make shit up. Realistically, but whether we call ourselves black or African American or whatnot, or indigenous or whatever, aboriginal, native or whatever, why Thanksgiving? To keep all of us at bay, to keep all of us in a comatose state. Our elders have come a long way. And they've been, like in this movie called Total Recall, lobotomized. You know, being the descendants of the generation that was before them, and so forth. You know, but we believe in the revolutionary transformation of society as a revolutionary organization. And that no more, no less than a political understanding can get us on the right track, on the right road. And so this is why tonight, you know, show, we chose Why Thanksgiving, you know, just to give some insight on that. You know what I'm saying? And there's nothing wrong with being a revolutionary. Black people have to take their own lives back in their own hands just to learn how to be again as human beings. You know what I'm saying? And on that note, we're gonna end here. And you know, we wanna thank those who be listening. And those who may have just started listening. We're not CNN, we're not Fox, we're not MSNBC. You know what I'm saying? Every little form of media is an opportunity to reach our people, to educate our people. Staying clear of the bullshit. The romanticism, the utopian idea of freedom, and so forth, selling lines, and you know, just the whole game of Negro version of freedom and justice and so forth in real time. You know, like Chairman Frey, you know, we say we have to stop fascism, you know, it'll stop us all or kill us all or whatnot in so many words. And so, you know, on that note, we say, you know, stay tuned. Look for us next week, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern, In Defense of the People Radio, brought to you by People's Political Party. I'm one of your hosts, Chairman Nat. My co-host, Brother Motherland, our National Minister of Defense, and our SOG technician, I like to refer to on the Wars and Tools, Sister Amino Shaw, our National Minister of Communication. And, so we say black power to black people specifically. And not narrow-minded enough not to be able to say all power to the people, because power should be in the hands of the people. And you hold rule, you know, in real time. You know, nothing like liberation, you know, to be in control of one's own life and one's own destiny, how he or she see fits collectively as a nation of people. And so we out of here.
All right, this young lady right there.
I'd like to make a comment, Mr. Malcolm. Now, you're right, of course, the black people are in the worst. They have had the worst treatment. But isn't it also possible that if the white people, the poor people, the people down in my neighborhood, the white people, those that don't work, those that are on welfare, those that have nothing, if they got together too, and you help us, we'll help you. You help us get up there. You help us get rid of some of these people that are pressing down on us.
No, I say you should be just as active in your neighborhood as we're trying as you have been in our neighborhood.
All right, we get our neighborhood still hot. Everybody's going for something. We alone, there are too few of us. There are too many men up there with all their cop cars and everything.
That's what they're always telling you. Never let your enemy tell you how many of you there are. Never let the man that you're against form your opinion. This is the trick that's played on everyone who's oppressed. The first thing, an occupation, when you have a revolution in the country, the first thing you take over is the radio. And then you start telling the people that everybody, the war is over. And so all of them surrender. No, they believe that thing right there. And once they take that over, they start telling you where you are and where they are, and you fall right in line. It's plain thought control. The majority of the American people aren't segregationists. That the majority of the American people aren't imperialists. But the government is, the structure is, the power faction is. So, how then do all the majority go along with it? Because those who sit in power over the television, over the radio, and over the press is constantly telling those who are the masses how free they are. And how this they are and how that they are. So a mistake is made on your part when you think that white people suffer the same as black people. Or as many Jews will say, well, we're a minority too. Or the Irish will say, well, we used to be a minority. No one's a minority like we are. They didn't need civil rights legislation to solve any other minority problems. It didn't take a civil war to solve any other minority problem. It didn't take Supreme Court decisions to solve any other minority problem or legislation. It takes none of that other kind of that action to solve the minority problems of these other people. The only real minority in America is the Afro-American. Now, when white people, who are oppressed and poor, supposedly, but the poorest white person can go where the richest black person can't go. It isn't only poverty in money. That we're talking about, poverty in spirit, poverty in freedom, poverty in equality, poverty in human dignity. This is the kind of poverty we're suffering from. So that the richest Negro in this country is still poor. When it comes to freedom, he's broke. When it comes to human dignity, he's broke. This is the kind of poverty we're talking about. So when you find white people who are poor, with all these doors that there are open to them, any door that you knock on, if you're qualified, it'll open. So when you find a poor white person, he's in bad shape. You didn't know that.